Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. Here we are off on one of our walks down the Wolverhampton Canals, and this is part four in our series about the body. Today we want to talk about death and mortality.
The body dies, nothing's more certain. You know the famous saying, there's two certainties in life, and only two, that is death and taxes. And it seems about right. I mean, at some point in the development of the human species, it must have started to loom large, as we became self-conscious creatures, that the body dies and decomposes, and the animals around us die and decompose. In fact, you know, we're a species that kills other animals for food and all the rest of it, you know, and use them as a resource. You know, we're predators. And
imagine as soon as we were becoming self-aware, death was pretty much in there straight away.
Yeah. And that's a... Well, death's an imponderable. And we experience the death of others, especially those we're attached to, you know, with great kind of pain and grief and bewilderment. Usually, most people do that. It's a big one. It really figures in human life enormously. Maybe the Christians, in the midst of life, we are in death, and they are actually right. You know. And what does the priest say? I think one of their ceremonies, they say this thing, don't they? You know, man, know that thou art dust; to dust thou shalt return. So there it is, the fact of the mortality of the body inscribed right into a culture, you know, and a culture's funerary rites are very central to its way of understanding the world. The culture's notion about death is right at the core of how we understand who we are and what we are, or how we attempt to understand who we are and what we are. The mortality of the body, I'm saying there, and to put it in a shorthand, is formative of our world picture, both as individuals and as societies and communities and collectivities. So we know that the body dies and decomposes, and it's had a mighty effect on us. In modern times, it's becoming more and more apparent that the correlation between one's, kind of call it, mental state, emotional state, state of being, is in a direct correlation of some sort with the state of our bodies. I mean, we've known this for a very long time, but it's been underscored heavily in modern times by developments in neuroscience, in brain imaging, and also the advent of the ability to do surgery on the brain. This tells us about this correlation between our body state and our mental state. Now, you might see that I've just as an aside here, that I've lapsed back into a Cartesian mind-body dualism here, talking about brain states and mental states and so forth, or body states and mental states, as though mind and body were two things. I'm just going to say, this is my assertion, this is the metaphysical imposition I want to make here, that these are not two. These are two ways of talking about the single thing, which is a human being. I'm not trying to put a massive conceptual schism into this talk, you know, in other words, a mind-body dualism. I'm not operating from that place. So, this correlation between the mental state and the body state, as I've mentioned, you know, it's got two, at least two, aspects to it, and the one is to do with our immediate felt lived experience. Just an example is pretty good here, I think, to illustrate what I'm on about. I mean, I am grumpy because my sciatica is bad today. Yeah. We've known this since we could talk, since we were self-conscious, we've known this.
And you've only got to look at a toddler who throws a fit because they're tired or because they're uncomfortable in some way.
Yeah. I mean, by the same token, I can say I feel up and joyous today because my body is springy and energetic and libidinal. And I underline that libidinal, you know, that kind of... plenty chewed of sexual energy, you know, it affects one's mood, kind of put it like that.
Yeah.
So, just going on a little bit more about the other aspect of this body state, mental state correlation, as I say, it's modern science, brain experiments. For instance, you know, you can stimulate somebody's brain with an electrode and produce a definite feeling. And know that if you stimulate a certain part of the brain, you'll produce a certain feeling, or a certain memory, or a certain brain, you know, a certain mental state. And of course, there's the use of brain imaging, MRI, and so on. There's a whole lot of new imaging technology in which you can you show a correlation between a brain state and a mental state. And for instance, you can stick somebody in a MRI machine or some machine of that type and have them looking at pictures that arouse specific emotions or specific memories. And you know which part of the brain will become more active, and the image on the computer screen will show you certain parts of the brain becoming active in correlation with certain emotions.
Yeah.
Somebody apparently has been getting people to have orgasms in one of these machines, you know, and other people have been given injections of psilocybin and then sent into the machine to see what that does to their brain, you know.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that would be such a pleasant experience.
No, me neither.
Anyway, that correlation, you know, is that we know instinctive, that we know just from our everyday experience, is underscored by the science.
Yeah.
Now, I want to say that this state of affairs, in which we have this scientific confirmation of an age-old observation from ordinary life about this mind-body correlation. In underscoring that myself, I'm not wanting to lead to any particular metaphysical conclusion. I don't think it particularly supports mind-brain identity theory or epiphenomenalism or any of these ideas. All we need to know really for these kind of existential discussions is that the mind-body correlation is very, very, very precise. and we know that the body dies, and that makes you suspect that all aspects of our lives as we know them from our own felt lived experience and memories, of course, I mean, the implication or the suspicion here is that, well, that goes too. It's so dependent on the body. How can it survive when the body is decomposed? So, and yet, most eschatologies...
Eschatologies?
Yes, theories about death, stories, narratives about death, do seem to posit some kind of persistence after the death and rotting of the body, of something that's a bit like the personality of the person as it was before they died.
Mm.
You know, this is the fantasy, you know, behind seances and all the rest of it. You know, and obviously there are different ideas about what happens to us when we die, what happens to this immortal part of us when we die. I'm saying that, the sensible suspicion here is that there is no immortal part of us. And certainly the stories about what happens after death, the religious stories, whether they talk about rebirth or going to paradise or to hell, they really just don't hold water in the face of the certain knowledge, observable knowledge, of the mind-brain correlation. So in other words, we die, guys, we die, and that's it. So... I mean, even in pre-scientific eras, you know, as I've just mentioned, it really was known, you know. I mean, because when the dead speak to us... When the dead speak to us, you know, in cultures which have the dead speaking to us, they are incorporeal. And really, they come to us as projections of ghosts, or projections, aren't they? Yeah. Or imaginings, you know, which might be individually idiosyncratic, but were probably culturally sanctioned. Think of the Mexican Day of the Dead and so forth. I mean, so what here is immortal? I say nothing. You know, we are well and truly mortal, because we are our bodies. And if you look at it like this, the stories do look like the stories about your immortal soul, and he's gone to a better place, and he's off up there shagging 40 virgins, or he's come back as a great sage, or he's been reborn in a Buddha heaven. Any of these fucking stories just look like wish fulfillment in the face of the undoubted terror and anxiety we feel in the face of death.
And this is one of the ways that we can react to the knowledge of death is, well, it's fear, and then buying how are we going to deal with the fear?
Exactly.
By inventing stories to help us, to comfort us.
And there are many stories waiting there on the peg to save us the bother of inventing our own.
Yes.
Some people do invent their own, but most people go, you know, they
off
go
off the peg.
Most
off
people
peg
shop
stories.
At Asda.
Yeah.
A few kind of eccentrics go to Waitrose, you know. So, and it's the same with the spiritual supermarket, and especially around the matter of death. Now, against that, I want to mention a phenomenon which William Wordsworth drew our attention to in the 19th century, which is the intimations of immortality. And what this boils down to is that there is an experience in which one feels immortal.
Yeah.
You know, I think, And in fact, Wordsworth wrote about it in a poem in which he recollects how as a child he had these feelings of immortality. And it's a feeling of being sort of quite present with yourself and with what's going on, and feeling it was always like this and it always will be like this. There's no beginning and no end. And it's a very real feeling. And Maharishi Ramana, who we've mentioned before, was full of this. You know, he's a guy who, as he was dying, sort of berated his disciples and lovers, I suppose they were, you know, for wailing and gnashing their teeth as he was dying. And he said, "Well, I'm here. Where can I go?" He had that feeling, you know, that you can't. There's nowhere to go. And I think this is definitely a very real thing, and it's very impressive. Those experiences are very impressive.
Well, I've certainly had that.
Yeah, I would say they can be had.
Yeah.
Through meditation. And it seems that, you know, when there's that kind of clarity comes about, and spaciousness in meditation, in which there's little particularity. There's not many of your petty little niggles in there, in the field of awareness. It's much clearer than that. And it does that. There's that feeling. Thus it was always. Thus it will be always. There is no beginning, no end. No coming, no going. It's a very, very real thing. It's mightily impressive. It's a known thing, but it's fairly uncommon. There might be some thousands of people on the planet at the moment who've experienced that and they're impressed by it, but that's out of 7 billion. You know, it's like that. It's something that's always going to be known about, but it's far less ubiquitous than the fear of death. What I want to say about that, just as I said about all the stuff regarding the brain and our mental inner life, you might call it, again, nothing metaphysical is decided by the fact of these impressive experiences. Just because something impresses you doesn't make it true. It makes you behave as though it was true, perhaps. It has an existential force, but it doesn't make it true. Of course, people always turn their impressive experiences into metaphysics. But it's a bad move, it's a wrong move. Certainly, if you have these impressive experiences, be existentially impressed by them, by all means, because they make you fearless, which is not a bad thing. It's a good, you know. But I'd imagine that that's how things are. That's how the universe is. It's an experience amongst, you know, one amongst many that are possible for the human, the embodied human being. They come out of the body. So again, the persistence of the soul superstition, as Nietzsche called it, that there is an immortal part of us, is still looking like wish fulfillment, in despite of the fact of impressive intimations of immortality, which I certainly experienced, and which you've experienced, and which people who meditate experience, and which some people sometimes experience with psychedelic drugs and so on, or extreme experiences. Childbirth, etc., you know, or the death of someone. It's very hard to feel that they've gone away, you know. In fact, you feel that them as a presence very often, more vividly than when they were alive. But again, nothing metaphysically is decided by any of this. And I think, you know, we know that we die. However religious we are, we know that we die. It's very, funerals interest me. I'm not morbid about this, but certainly a modern Christian funeral, which is a pretty sort of strange affair to my mind. People will be upset and they'll cry and they'll weep. And yet, the man in the frock at the front officiating in the funeral proceedings will say, he's gone to a better place. He's in the bosom of Jesus. You know. So, if people really believe that, why are they crying? Yeah. Oh, I know there are answers to that, you know, but the whole contradiction, the whole kind of suppressed nature of our deep knowledge, of our own body's deep knowledge that it is mortal, is just that it's out there, you know, it's apparent in collision with the wish fulfillment fantasy. It's just very, very clear, very clear. So what I wanted to say at this point is that our whole culture, our whole world picture, is shaped in many ways. It's not the only factor, but it's a big shaping factor by the mortality of our bodies. In fact, our mortality, full stop. We know we're mortal.
Yeah.
And it's been such a big deal in human culture. I mean, look at the pyramids.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy's in there, right in the middle of this thing, mummified, you know, with all the stuff that's ready for him to, when he wakes up in the next world, he's got all these artifacts.
Yeah, this vast amount of effort gone into these
things.
Well,
look at it, you know. That's the biggest fuck-off tombstone on the planet, but
yeah.
That big pyramid there in Egypt. I mean, Otto Rank is a very interesting disciple of Freud's. He wrote a book called, I think it's called Art and Immortality, and he puts the genesis of art down to this compensatory desire for immortality. Art itself, you know, is having its roots in that. And it's quite kind of, his thesis is quite convincing. I don't think he got it dead right, but he's certainly onto something, you know. So just putting that together in and drawing it into something a bit more succinct, I would say the shaping of our world picture and of our culture and of the way we as individuals embedded in a particular culture engage with life comes from the body. It comes from the body and our knowledge that body is us. And our knowledge that body is mortal and will die and will go cold and stiff and will rot. On that basis, we should never see our world picture as God-given. You know, as somehow how it really is. our world picture, isn't how it really is. It's a contingent bit of our operating system that arises out of our need for meaning, our need for explanation, but also our need to accommodate and perhaps tame the anxiety we mostly feel about death and mortality. So these things, these big stories, you know, are not worth dying for.
Yeah.
And we have them because we die, and we haven't really, to my mind yet, hacked the best way of dealing with that.
So in your opinion, what would be a better way of dealing with the knowledge of death, rather than the fear response?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, as you can probably figure out, I think the fear response really attenuates our possibilities for living vividly and having a great human life. I think that's kind of obvious. You know, if we have a world picture through which supplies us, in a sense, with a set of lenses to view the world, you know, we are then restricted to what those lenses will let us see. You know, it's strangulating. You know, it's a straitjacket. Plus, yeah, all this stuff is used for social control.
Yeah.
You know, people with the psychopathic controlling mentality will use any human tendency that can be predicted. And this is one that can be predicted, you know. But yeah, I mean, the mortality, you know, it's that angst around death, the fear of death, the uncertainty of what it is, even, because, you know, nobody's come back from beyond the veil to tell us. Bearing in mind that most seances and such like things are just frauds. But I'd say it's very deep-seated. I even realise yogis struggle with this, according to Patanjali. He notes that however much equanimity we've got through meditation, tapas practice, however reconciled we are with all facets of our existence, however much siddha power we've got over the unfolding of events, yet still our bodies shudder in resistance at the approach to death. So the body wants to live. The body wants to live.
Yeah.
It must die, but it wants to live. Yeah. So I'm saying that, you know, I'm not trying to be kind of flip about people's eschatological commitments about what they believe about death and the things that they say at funerals that comfort them. It's deep-seated, it's profound. Yeah. And I say even Patanjali notices the force with which the body wants to live, which colours all of this, you know, as well. And there's a life component as well as a fear component. But if you look at an argument like the one I've given here, you know, it's like this: it's the sensible, rational, though by no means conclusive argument, but well, we are, we die, and that's it. And it's certainly how it seems to me, you know. We die and that's it. And there's a couple of reactions then possible if you go down that line. If you don't want to be jerked about by fear into believing all kinds of shit.
Right. I do.
You could respond, you know, you can respond to the abyss that then opens up of nothingness, you know.
Be quite depressed by that.
And be quite depressed, yeah, and yeah, melancholy, and feel hopeless and nihilistic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the arguments given by religious apologists is that that religious belief counters that very nihilism and despair. But there's a third option here, you know, which doesn't entail giving into the fear and believing loads of shit. Which doesn't entail falling into a nihilism of despair, and that is to be enlivened and vivified by the fact of your own death.
Yeah. And this is certainly my reaction to death after having it rubbed quite thoroughly in my face when I was about 19 or 20. Mm-hmm. I can't quite remember when it was. Yeah. When you're a teenager, and certainly as a child, you have that, you do think you're going to live forever, don't you? It doesn't really cross your mind.
Yeah.
But then, you know, once somebody close to you dies, it's like, oh yes, this is real.
Yeah.
And especially when somebody dies suddenly and unexpectedly, mm-hmm. and that shock is really...
Yeah,
it's very powerful.
It's
very
powerful.
When that happened to me, I meditated on that for years, and you know, mm-hmm. certainly in relation to myself. And round about that time, I was reading Carlos Castaneda.
Oh yes.
And for all his faults, he did come up with quite a good line where he said, "Death is your best advisor."
Absolutely.
And that made me feel not frightened by death, but almost like the knowledge of death, the full in the bones knowledge of death, not just the abstract mm-hmm. knowledge of death, but really knowing, gave me just incredible clarity, like a much deeper, richer clarity, like a particular flavour, I would say, of clarity that informs my life and helps me to make better decisions, I feel.
You feel, yes.
Yeah. But also puts things in great perspective as well.
Yeah. It also, don't you think, gives you the mentality of carpe diem, carpe momentum.
That's right,
you know, grasp the day, grasp the moment.
Yeah.
And it's because the moment is ephemeral, and that the memory will die when the body dies and rots also, that actually gives it its beauty.
Yeah.
You know, real lived experience is sparkling and dynamic.
Yeah.
And beautiful. You know, and sublime. It's not a waxworks. You know, it's not a waxworks of permanence and unchangingness.
Yeah,
all of its beauty and flavour resides in the fact that it's transient, and that these mysterious creatures that we are, that are able to register this in some way, will ourselves pass from the picture.
Yeah, and I didn't struggle with fear ever, really, particularly. I mean, the horrible shock and the pain of loss and all of that was definitely there. But the fear of death, I never had to conquer the fear of death to get to the point where it was, we were using this word before, exhilarating.
Yeah. It's in the right ballpark, but it's not quite the right word.
It's not quite the right word. We were trying to think of a better word, but... It's exhilarating, but not in the same way as a bungee jumping is exhilarating. It's a different kind of exhilarating. It just makes you feel more richly alive at knowledge of death. And so it's just like it's a completely different response to the fear response. It's almost at the other end of the spectrum, where it's almost joyful.
Yes. Yeah.
And better than merely joyful, it's actually useful.
Yeah.
It's like the embracing the knowledge of death and not being frightened of it is practically useful.
Yeah.
And I feel...
It's your advisor.
As Don Juan said,
or Don Gennaro.
Yeah, it is. And that's how it feels. Whenever you're certainly making big life decisions, or even small life decisions, really, if it's just constantly there, you know, sitting on your left shoulder, being there, advising you, it gives very good advice, actually.
Yeah.
I've always found.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
But I've had these conversations with people who are very frightened of death and have, you know, all sorts of stories to help to comfort them, comfort the fear and make the fear less powerful for them.
Yeah.
And they've asked me, well, how do I not be frightened of death? How do I not be despondent? and depressed that I'm going to die, and there will be nothing left of me after I've dead, and I don't know really.
Yeah. Well, it's an attitude, I think, you know, and I think that having a bit of insight about your own motivations isn't that difficult.
Yeah.
You know, you can see.
We get into the how questions where we always get to.
Well, it's about seeing with whatever clarity you can muster, whatever is happening, you know. And if you can manage that, which it's not a major operation, you know, it's something that our brains are hardwired to do anyway. You catch glimpses of how you compensate for what's fearful and awkward and anxious. You can see how you calm yourself with stories and with all kinds of other things, you know. So it's not that difficult, you know.
Sometimes but it's potentially more frightening.
Yeah. Well, I think
when you see how the first stage, when you see how you are actually self-calming yourself by the stories and everything. And then suddenly the stories drop away, and then it's really frightening for a little while, isn't it?
Well,
because all that support
pristine.
Is gone for a moment.
It's pristine.
It's just ripped out from underneath you. I suppose maybe for me, because the rug was ripped out from underneath me so very suddenly.
You didn't have time.
At quite an early age. Yeah. You know, as I say, I was 20 years old. Just suddenly gone.
Yeah.
I mean, I did at least 2 years meditating on childhood and being a child, and I really felt like I wasn't a child anymore. It was like very, very impressed upon me that innocence had gone.
Yeah.
And it was very painful, but I worked through it using art, actually.
Yeah.
So I was doing my art degree at the time.
Yeah.
So I did lots and lots of artwork about death and childhood.
Yeah.
And must say that really helped. So I could maybe give that as advice to somebody who wanted to explore these things. The expressing it through art, but not the kind of art that was is done particularly to be viewed by other people.
Yeah.
Something which is just
personal art therapy, really.
Yeah, so. Really. That's what I did for a couple of years. Yeah. Yeah. My tutors weren't very impressed, but fuck them.
Yeah.
You know,
what do
I was doing what I wanted to do, which is the
know?
Most important thing.
What do they know?
Yeah. So, that was very helpful.
Mm.
And it gave me lots and lots of time to meditate on this and to think about it and to allow it to permeate my being, let it to really sink in very deeply.
Yeah.
I think I was lucky that it happened at that stage in my life, because I didn't have a job or responsibilities. I could really just devote myself to embracing this new way of being.
Yeah. Well, as we mentioned, it's vivid and aesthetically alive, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's the conclusion I came to by going into it, thrashing around, obviously, for a while.
Yeah.
But yes, it's the response of allowing it to enhance your life.
Yeah.
Allowing the knowledge of death to enhance your life is that's great.
It seems like a sensible way to go.
Yeah.
Even though, as I say, we shouldn't underestimate how ingrained our tendency to treat death as awesome, at least as awesome.
Yeah.
How deeply ingrained that is, and how much our bodies want to live. And I think that's real, and I think you should embrace that too, you know.
Yeah.
You may feel you made your peace with death, but I would say to people, don't do that at the price of covering over or denying its awesome character. It absolutely is. It remains. In fact, it's more awesome.
Yeah.
Than when you think you've got the story, you know.
Yeah. True knowledge of death is probably the most awesome thing there is, really. So I hope that was helpful for people. Bit of a ramble there, but I think we covered the bases.
Yeah.
So we will be seeing you in our next podcast, which is sex and reproduction.
Is it?
I think it is, yes.
Oh.
I think that's where we're going next.
We should do some research
on
that one.
Yes, we should do some research. Okay. We'll report back on that one.
Okie doke. Yes, we will. Bye.